The gospel lesson for this morning is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 20, as you see the verses printed in your bulletin. This will be also the passage for the sermon this morning. I invite us all to listen again for Luke's gospel and for the Word of God. Some Sadducees, those who say there is no resurrection, came to Jesus and they asked him a question. "Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry the widow and raise up children for his brother. Now, there were seven brothers. The first married and died childless. The second and the third married her. And so in the same way, all seven died childless. Finally, the woman also died. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife will the woman be? For the seven had married her." Jesus said to them, "Those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age and in the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Indeed, they cannot die anymore because they are like angels and are children of God, being children of the resurrection. And the fact that the dead are raised, Moses himself showed in the story about the bush where he speaks of the Lord as the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now he is God not of the dead, but of the living. For to him all of them are alive." And then some of the scribes answered, "Teacher, you've spoken well." For they no longer dared to ask him another question. This is the word of the Lord. At one of the times that Jesus was teaching in Jerusalem, in the temple there, the last week that he was in Jerusalem, the week of his crucifixion, a group of Sadducees came to him and they asked him a question. This is already a setup, though, because this is what happens as we just read it when they asked that question. We're already told in verse 27, the very first verse of the passage, that the Sadducees, and this is unlike the Pharisees. Oftentimes the Pharisees and the Sadducees are associated together in the scriptures. But in this case, unlike the Pharisees, the Sadducees were told emphatically, don't believe in resurrection. And yet the very question that they pose to Jesus is about resurrection. There's something going on here in their question. It's insincere or it's just speculative. They're game playing, intellectual game playing. Something's going on here. Listen again to how some of it goes. Luke says, some Sadducees, those who say there is no resurrection, came to him and asked, Teacher, Moses wrote for us that if a man's brother dies, leaving a wife but no children, the man shall marry and the widow shall raise up children for the brother. And now the Sadducees are really referring to something that's very important to know. They're referring to what was called the Levirate Code, a law in Israel. And it was a compassionate and practical law. It was a very well-intended and well-placed law. It was there to protect widows in that society where women had very little standing when their husbands died. It was also there because the Israelites believed that a person lived on through their descendants in some way. And so this was a way of making sure that there would still be children in the family to pass on the memories, to hold on to the memories of the parents. And then finally, it was a very practical law that was a guarantee of trying to keep property in the family when the family owned property. So the Sadducees seem to be asking a legitimate question. They're referring to this Levirate law, but that's not really their point. We really hear their point when they get very facetious with the question that they're asking. Now, there were seven brothers. That's an exaggeration already. Seven brothers. The first married and died childless, the second. And then they go on, and they make a joke of it, really. They carry it out to what's really a joke because they come to this outrageous conclusion that all seven of the brothers die, and none of the marriages brings any children into the family. And then finally they say, and then the woman also died. And then this facetious question. Teacher, in the resurrection, now remember, they don't even believe in the resurrection. Whose wife will the woman be? There are questions and then there are questions. There are questions that sincerely ask for information, that want more details, questions that we ask in order to learn. There are questions that give another person a chance to share their feelings, to open their heart, as we would say, to give someone some compassion and a listening ear. They're questions that we ask to get to know someone better, to show real interest in their lives. There are, of course, rhetorical questions, questions where the answer is already set up by the assumption. None of those questions is the kind of question that the Sadducees are asking here. They're being facetious. Maybe they're being belligerent. Maybe they're trying to entrap Jesus. It's not really clear from the way Luke writes this. There are several ways that we could look at this passage this morning. But this morning, I want to focus and I want to suggest to you about the way the Sadducees ask this question, that more than anything else, it's casual. It's cavalier. It's detached. It's indifferent to what they really seem to be asking. But most of all, it's cynical. They're not really interested in discussing the theology of the resurrection. They're not really open to learning anything new and to understanding their beliefs better and to somehow enlarging their faith. Cynicism has been described in a lot of ways, I know. I would suggest that cynicism at its core is a way of, it's taking the position of standing back and distancing ourselves from something that's very important because we don't want to take it seriously and truly involve ourselves in it. If we take it seriously, we would have to commit ourselves to whatever we're talking about, to whatever is important. Cynicism is determining and acting to avoid meaningful commitment. Being cynical means we don't want to take something that's very important in life and really make an effort to commit ourselves to it because it might change us. It might transform us. And sometimes for us, the prospect of being transformed, being changed, is a lot more threatening than just maintaining, as we say. So even though the Sadducees are religious people, we know that very well. The records on the Sadducees are not, they're pretty sparse. But we know they're religious. They don't believe in resurrection. And yet they put on this act with Jesus of somehow being interested in the theology of resurrection. But they're not. And Jesus knows that from the beginning. So in the next verses, if you notice, he refuses to go along with them. He refuses to be led into some further discussion the way they've set it up. He takes a whole different direction, and he uses exactly what they've said to come back at them and to teach them a lesson on resurrection if they're willing to open up to it in spite of themselves. Essentially, what Jesus says, I think, in those verses is to the Sadducees, and it is that if they were really open to what resurrection means, they'd have a chance to understand it better. They'd have a chance to understand that so far they've totally misunderstood it. And then they could learn. They could deepen. They could grow deeper in their faith. In verse 34, Jesus says, "Those who belong to this age marry and are given in marriage, but those who are considered worthy of a place in that age in the resurrection of the dead, neither married nor given in marriage." He's saying to them, you've taken the whole wrong look at it here. You're coming from the wrong direction. And he says, indeed, they cannot die anymore because they're like angels and they are children of God, being children of the resurrection. And then, as you heard, he moves down a few verses and he says, now God is God, not of the dead. They wanted to refer to what happened after death. God is God, not of the dead, but of the living. For to him all are children of the resurrection. All are alive in the resurrection. What Jesus is essentially saying here, I think, is that real resurrection, not the facetious, ridiculous resurrection that the Sadducees have created in this question, real resurrection is so different from, and it's so much greater than what they've brought up, that we really have to commit to understand it. We can't just stand back from it. We can't just speculate. We can't just cynically deny it, like we can't any of the important beliefs in our faith. And in fact, at the end of the passage, some of the bystanders there turn out to be scribes, approve of what Jesus says. They say, "Teacher, you've spoken well." And then it says, "No longer did anyone dare to question him." The great 20th century Southern writer, Flannery O'Connor. A lot of us have read some of Flannery O'Connor's material. She was a devout Catholic from Milledgeville, Georgia. Flannery O'Connor was asked once, and this was decades ago already, why she thought the novel seemed to be in demise, seemed to be in decline. And she said something that to me is a profound and worthwhile listening to remark. She said, "People without hope not only don't write novels, but more to the point, they don't read them." Now, this is not just about novels, but she says, They don't take long looks at anything. Notice that, long looks at anything, because they lack the courage. The way to despair is to refuse to have any kind of experience. And she says, and the novel, of course, is a way of having an experience. And then she finishes off by saying these words. Modern people don't take long looks at anything. Not necessarily because we're intellectually lazy, she says, which we surely are. But she says mostly because we lack the courage. Why have I taken this approach among several in, that I could have taken in the sermon on this passage this morning? I'm not claiming here to have any special or any thoroughgoing knowledge or expertise when I say this. But it seems to me that this can be borne out. I think cynicism has become somewhat of an admired characteristic in our lives. It's become somewhat of an approved position, not just in our society, but right in the church. And I don't mean just our church, I mean the church. Standing back at a distance and not wanting to make an effort, not wanting to be too committed to anything. It also seems to me that the opposite of true commitment is true. And I think we experience it a lot, and I'm talking about the loud posturing, the chest thumping that we see and hear around us, the anger around us. And I'm not talking just about politics by any stretch of the imagination. I think this has been with us a while. It's in the church too, though, and we see it in destructive ways sometimes in what's happened in our denominations in recent decades. When it comes down to it, though, neither cynicism on the one hand nor rigid posturing is true commitment. Cynicism comes from a suspicion of and a discomfort with making a commitment. It comes from refusing to make something to make a commitment to something that is deep and may transform our lives. And then on the other hand, the loud posturing, I think, comes from a fear that I may not be as right as I think I am. I may not have the whole truth. And so if I just talk loudly enough, if I just talk forcefully enough, then that'll cover up what I'm insecure and uncertain about. And again, it concerns me that there's too much of that coming in from society into our church. I may be wrong about what I've just said, and certainly willing for you to disagree with me or disagree with the force with which I've said it. But what I do know for certain is that the church, the way we act, the way we react, the way we are with one another, the attitudes that we show outside of this sanctuary, those cannot be the same as the world around us ever. Because as soon as they are, we've compromised our witness to Jesus Christ. Now, having said that, I don't want to finish the sermon sounding like I'm being insensitive or hardline. There are circumstances and experiences in people's lives that make belief and make commitment to God and to Jesus Christ very, very hard. A veteran pastor reflects over the years in his pastorate, and he says, I've seen two kinds of disbelief. One kind, as he describes it, is that lonely but rather heroic disbelief that comes at the end of a long, tortured journey of the soul for reasons that can't be moved and because of pain that's too deep to heal. And he talks about a woman in his church. He says, she told me that she just couldn't believe in God in spite of all of her attempts to do that. She said, because, you see, my beloved daughter died at the age of 5. And when I left the hospital, my belief left with me. But then this pastor says, in my experience, that kind of disbelief is rare. He says, much more common, I find, is disbelief that comes from failure of intellectual nerve or from a deep, lazy spiritual unwillingness to try to learn and to risk. Well, we Christians are Easter people. That's not a cliche. We're not just Easter people one Sunday in the spring. We live for life, and we live for hope, and we live for love. Our message every day in our lives should be that there is new life, there's new hope, there's life in Jesus Christ. The tomb is empty. He's been raised. He's not in the tomb anymore. And people will see that in the way we live and in the commitments that we make, or they won't. Amen.